I have been given the Beatitudes to cover, which is chapter 5 of Matthew, verses 1 to 12. And the title that is in today's bulletin is the Beatitudes, the calling of believers to Jesus, who has he called? I went the shorter route, and as you can see from my slide, it's platitudes versus Beatitudes. And I didn't do that just to have a catchy title or to have something that rhymed or whatever. I wanted to really approach the Beatitudes by way of comparison with what the world teaches. Because if you read chapter 5 and you read all, the eight blesseds are, there's some really serious, hard, pithy guidance there, information. And you could spend a lifetime going through these and never get to the end of them. If you really, really thought about them, you could spend a whole lifetime going through these. And I was thinking about, you know, the world's wisdom. The world, if you go to the world for wisdom, the world will give you platitudes because they're easy and they sound profound, but all they really do is draw your gaze onto yourself. And you know what the platitudes that I'm talking about, you know, follow your dreams, you know, believe in yourself, all of those things. And I thought about it and I said, you know, who is the actual champion of platitudes? What is the platitude making machine that straddles the world? And that is Disney. Disney is a platitude generating behemoth. And so I wanted to show you just a few slides with some of the platitudes that I culled from the hundreds I could have from Disney movies. Now, if you are a fan of the Magic Kingdom, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to poke any eye. It's just that, you know, it was almost like there was so many I could spend 15 minutes going through, but I just have a couple for you. So here we go. Here's the first one. This is from Pocahontas. Listen with your heart, you will understand. On the surface, that sounds profound. And if there's a song coming and there's you can see the leaves are swirling around her and she's singing, it all sounds really profound and deep. Until you actually confront it in print and you look at it and you say, what? Listen with your heart, you will understand. I'm like, I don't understand. What am I doing with this? Now maybe I'm the old guy and I'm not tuned into this, but I have no idea what this woman is telling me to do. Listen with your heart, you will understand. Thank you. Here's another one. This is a Disney movie called Brave. I didn't even know there was a Disney movie called Brave. My kids are grown up, so I'm out of touch with Disney. So here's one. Our fate lives in us. You only have to be brave enough to see it. There are so many different versions of this on the internet. It's on mugs and it's on magnets for your refrigerator and t-shirts. And I swear, after staring at it for several days after downloading all, I absolutely have no idea what this person is saying to me. Our fate lives in us. You only have to be brave enough to see it. Does that mean I'm a coward if I don't live? My fate is my fate. Like, it doesn't make any sense. But again, there were t-shirts with this on it and mugs and magnets. So the world will give us this and someone will sell it to us and we will buy it and put it on our desks or our fridges or whatever. And just so you are not thinking, well, you know, that's new Disney, new politically correct Disney. Classic Disney would have never done anything like this. The Disney of the 60s or whatever. So here we go. Cinderella. I think this is Cinderella, isn't it? Have faith in your dreams and someday your rainbow will come smiling through. I was like, okay, but a rainbow is like a smile that's upside down, right? It's like a frown. So I went down this path of trying to make sense out of it, and I was like, what am I trying to make sense of this? This is the world's wisdom giving me these platitudes that are just empty at the, you know, to use another sort of platitudey thing, at the end of the day, these are so empty. They might sound great when someone's singing a song or when it's part of a movie or this uplifting scene, but in the end, you know, when really you sit down and think about it, they're empty. There's nothing here for me to give me any kind of guidance, to give me any kind of wisdom, to give me any kind of, I mean, they give me a false hope that somehow if I listen with my heart or if I follow my dreams or if I'm brave enough to see what my fate is, which I had no idea what my fate is. I can't even tell you what's going to happen to me in the next minute. And if I trust that my dreams will give me a rainbow, you know, this stuff, it's a false hope and it's like fast food. There's nothing there. So I wanted to frame, you know, the Beatitudes as an opposite to this, because the world will give you this. The world will force feed you this. The world is only too willing to give you all of this stuff. Okay? But the world is not a big fan of what God is saying in Scripture, because a lot of this stuff is hard to hear, it's hard to understand, and you have to want to live it. So I'm going to read with you in the King James Version, Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 to 12. Okay? And seeing the multitudes, Jesus went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him. And then notice he's talking to his disciples, those that are following him, those that are around him. He's not talking to everyone per se in this situation. He's talking to those men that are around him, those people that are around him. And he opened his mouth and he taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you." It's verses 1 to 12. And for those of you that are of a programming bent, you know, you've got a lot of statements here that start with blessed, and then the second part begins with for. Blessed, whatever, for, this will happen. A lot of those statements, you have eight of them there, okay? And I'm not going to discuss or pick apart necessarily why these are constructed the way these are, why he chose these eight blessings as opposed to any others. And I toyed with the idea even of going back into the Old Testament and saying, okay, here are scenes from the Old Testament that match these eight sayings. I'm not going to go over that either. And the reason why I'm not going to do that is I was told not to do that. And unfortunately, I was told to do something else. And I don't want to do this. I really don't want to do this next part. I really have no desire to do this. But this is what I was basically told to do. And you know, I was questioning it. I only had about a week to go on this because I was asked to do this last week. And I was like, you know, Lord, you know, I got to get up to speed with this. He's like, you got to do this. Because if I don't do this next part, basically what he said to me is, you're just going to do a lot of platitudes yourself about the Beatitudes if you don't say what you need to say. So that's a bit of a preamble, but I do have to tell you something. And like I said, I would really rather not tell you this, but, you know, I'm going to. So here's my second apology. If this makes you uncomfortable, I apologize. But if you're uncomfortable, imagine how I feel about this. So here we go. Hang on. Of all the Sundays to be up here, one where there's no air conditioning and it's steamy, it's like the worst. I'm not a warm weather person. So this is actually kind of tough up here. Okay. So here's the part I don't necessarily want to talk about, but it really totally sets the stage for why we have these words from God. Karen, for a number of years now, and I couldn't tell you how long, maybe a couple years now at least, has been trying to get me to talk to a counselor. She caught me one day in an unguarded moment. Before she caught me, I had been sort of under the impression that I was able to hide, you know, what was going on in my mind from her. And what would happen is, especially if I was going into a very dark place, I would wind up separating myself, going to do something. And the most logical thing to do was go do the dishes, because ain't nobody wants to be around you when you're doing the dishes, because they want you to do the dishes and they don't have to deal with it. So Karen was more than willing to let me do the dishes every night. Not a knock on Karen, but she was happy to have me do that. So a lot of times if I was going down a really dark path, I would just go and do the dishes. Kind of work through that on my own, in the dishes, nobody's coming in the kitchen, I'm all by myself. So I don't know if she sneaked up on me or what, but she caught me. And when I say she caught me, she caught the look on my face. I don't have a poker face. I think I've learned that. Now, I can lie with a straight face. I've been married for 30 years, so I know how to lie with a straight face. So when I'm ready to do it, I can lie and I can be believable. But she caught me when I didn't really know she was there, and she was like, I just realized she was like watching me, and I was like, oh, here it comes. And she was like, you know, where are you? So in an unguarded moment, I actually told her, which is another rule that husbands should have, is never tell your wife what you're thinking. That is like insane. But I did. I told her. I told her what I was thinking. I told her what was going on in my head, which was stupid, but I did. And I think I pretty much terrified her by what I was saying. So that's when she started saying, look, you need to go talk to a counselor about this. And I'm like, yeah, no. And she's gotten a bit more insistent over the subsequent weeks and months and years, because I think she really does feel that someday she's going to look for me and I'm not going to be here anymore. And she's going to need to say, all right, where did he leave the note? You know, where's the note? Which I would never do, because that is so selfish. And I'd be leaving her a mess to clean up, but this is what she's worried about. And so I'm trying to say to her that I don't want to talk to a counselor, because I don't want to put my faith or my hope or my future in some guy's hands. Because then if I do that, I'm committing to have this guy prop me up today and tomorrow and the next day and next week and next month. And, you know, the theme of our message is resilience. So if I go to a counselor, I'm just going to have to commit to him making me resilient. And he's not going to do that. He's really not. I have really no faith that he'll be able to do that. We took Gilbert to 3 different counselors when he was younger, and he was having some real struggles. And we took him to 3 different ones, and I was there for all 3 different. I wasn't there every session, but I was there. I listened to all 3 good people. And they gave him the world's wisdom. They gave him the world's, you know, platitudes. And they weren't going to fix him, you know, by him going to see them Thursday at 4:30 in the afternoon. They weren't going to fix him. They weren't even really going to help him. He didn't tell them everything that he was thinking, because he didn't trust them. And they weren't really asking, I don't think, the right questions. They sort of had a checklist and they kind of went down that. And so I looked at them and I said, well, it's not like we just had one bad experience. I feel like we had 3 bad experiences. And it's not like we just, you know, opened up the phone book and went, okay, we'll call that person and see if he can help. We took recommendations. We listened to people. We did the best that we could do to get him the best help. And I came away from those sessions. I mean, I remember the last one that we went to, that Gilbert and I went to. I actually went to the last one with him. And we're driving home and he's just like venting about it. And I'm like, dude, I'm with you 100%. He's like, I'm not going back. I said, I'm with you on that. So, you know, I had no hope that a counselor, I think, is going to help me. And the one thing that I want to make clear about that is, if I commit to this guy, then he's got to commit to me. And so he needs to be sitting next to me at 5 o'clock in the morning when I'm eating my cornflakes. And I'm saying, well, same stuff going on, different day, different work day, same work day as yesterday, and it's going to be the same as tomorrow. When I'm sitting there saying, what is the point of all of this? He's got to be sitting right next to me. He can have a bowl of cornflakes, I don't care. But he's got to be able to say, live your dream, Dan. You know, he's got to give me that platitude. And when I'm standing on the train platform and I'm seeing people being so incredibly rude and selfish and self-centered to each other, and it's just, maybe you don't feel this way, but just standing next to people and watching them exhibit like the worst behavior, that the worst of human nature, is just, it grates on you. Right now we have this SEPTA crisis where a third of the cars are out of service. And so everyone, it's like every man for himself, this is the last train out of Saigon. You know, this is this 5:59 in the morning, right? It's not the last train out of Saigon. But you know, there's a handicap ramp that sort of snakes its way up. And so all of the people figured out that if they go on the handicap ramp, they can jump into the car first, the first car. They can jump into the quiet car first and get their favorite seat, because their day will absolutely be ruined if they don't get their favorite seat on the train on the way in. So they all congregated on the handicap ramp to get on the train first. And guess what happens to the woman with the two arthritic hips and the cane who hobbles up every morning? Guess what happens to her? She has to wait on the platform until they all jump on the train and get their special seats, and then she has to hobble up the platform and get on, you know, the ramp and get in the train. She should be first. She should be standing there first. They should make sure she gets on first. But if she hobbles her way up, other people will jump in and get my favorite seat, and I can't do that. So these people literally shove this woman down the ramp and onto the platform because they want to get into the train. Now, you might think, well, that's a minor thing. That's just one of the behaviors that I see. And so if I'm committing to this counselor, he better be standing next to me. It's 6 o'clock for the 5:59. Standing next to me on the train platform saying, be the difference, Dan. You know, he needs to be propping me up, because I'm seeing all of this behavior and it's just like, why do we do this to each other? And, you know, probably the worst part of my day is he's got to walk with me past all the drug addicts that line that corridor in Market Street, down 10th Street, all the way about 7th or 8th on Market Street. There's one woman, her name is Tracy, or at least that's what she wrote on the card. She writes on her little poster thing. I walk by her every day. Tracy, she's a heroin addict, and I got to walk by her every day. And I get tired of walking by her without looking at her. So, you know, another believer said, why don't you just give her a bottle of water every day? If you don't want to give her money, give her water. And I thought, oh, why didn't I think of that? So I give her a bottle of water every morning when I go to work, and she calls me sweetie. It's really, she's a sweetheart person, but she's a heroin addict. And so, you know, Mr. Counselor better be walking with me when we go past Tracy, and he better say, you know, be the difference, Dan. Better prop me up and make me resilient. Because I'm looking at Tracy saying, why? Why does it have, you know, why? What happened to her that it has to be this way? And, you know, most importantly of all, and I'm coming to the end of this, so hang in there, you're almost there. Most importantly, this counselor, you know, better be at my back door at 2:30 in the morning or whenever. When I'm letting Simon in or out or back in again. He's a cat. That's how he rolls. He's in and out all night. It's amazing. He better be there at my back door that early in the morning, because that's when the voice is so loud and everybody's asleep. I'm all by myself. And the voice is so loud at that point, telling me to go down a path. You know, I should not go down that path. There's no other voice that I hear but that one at that point. So that guy better be there. That counselor better be there at my back door, right next to me, saying, you could be strong, giving me some more platitudes when I'm hearing what I'm hearing. Now, he's not, right? You know, I can't call a counselor every time I need to be propped up. Every time I need to be resilient, I can't call him. You know, it would get tiresome on his part if I called him every time I needed him. And you know, at 2:30 in the morning, I can't even wake up Karen and tell her what's going on in my head, because You do not mess with Karen's sleep cycle. I've learned that over the years. You may remember this slide, right? See the fiery, redheaded Celtic woman. I married a reserved, redheaded English woman. But if I wake her up in the middle of the night, she does an incredible, fiery, redheaded Celtic woman imitation. My son-in-law and I have this inside joke, and the punchline is there a problem here? That was one of the times that she woke up because there was something going on in the middle of the night. Another time I woke her up, I had pink eye, and I woke her up at 12:30. I said, dude, my eyes are totally crusted shut. I cannot see. I got to get to the ER. Can you take me? Ay, ay, ay. I wound up saying to her, that's okay, I'll walk it. And I think that shamed her into taking me, but she was not pleased. It was tough. So you don't wake Karen up in the middle of the night. So I got no one at 2:30 in the morning who's going to help me. No human going to help me at 2:30 in the morning. So that is why I don't want to talk to a counselor. Because if I commit to him, he got to commit to me. If I need him to prop me up and make me resilient, then he better be there for me. And he's not going to be. And he's not going to be ready to deal with what I need him to deal with. You know? So who does that leave me? And the obvious answer is God. And that's who I have been going to. It's a rather long story. If I tell this to Karen, I'm not sure she's going to get it because she's just afraid that someday something bad's going to happen. And I can tell you honestly here, just, you know, between you and me, if anything bad does happen to me, it's because I stopped listening to God. It won't be God's fault. It'll be because I stopped listening. Because no man going to help me, going to make me resilient. There's no way. So having said all that, and the point of all of that that I said to you is, you know, this sets the stage for realizing that the world's wisdom and man's wisdom and man's help is always going to leave us empty. It's going to leave us in the lurch as it is. But when you look at the Beatitudes, this shows us where we got to go and who we have to go to. Now, I'll tell you honestly, over the years that I've been, you know, dealing with this, I didn't necessarily get drawn to the Beatitudes. I didn't really have to. But in the week that, you know, Tim said, look, you got to go do this message, it's been a real blessing for me to realize, it's almost like a confirmation to realize that, yeah, I'm looking in the right place. I just have to keep looking in the right place and not trust anybody else. So what I'd like to do in the last few minutes that I have left is to go through the eight blesseds are and just sort of rework them in my own vernacular. Now, I know that it's my own vernacular, and I know that it's very idiosyncratic because it's fitting where I'm at right now, but I just wanted to go through them in sort of like Dan's English, if you will. So let's get started. Verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Or another way of saying that is blessed are those people who have come to the end of their own resources. Blessed are those that got nothing. If you got nothing, nothing left, then God has you where he wants you. Because if you think you can handle it, if I'm going to some counselor and thinking, well, okay, now I can be resilient, I can handle this because I got this guy propping me up, then I'm not letting God do anything. I'm basically handling it myself. But God says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those people who have come to the end and have nothing left. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You've got me. You have all of everything that I have. You have me. Who else do you need? Verse 4, blessed are those that mourn. And when I say mourn, I'm not talking about sad about your own life, what you got or what you don't got or what you would like to have or whatever. But those people who mourn because of this world, all that it entails, the absolute horror, for lack of a better word, of this world. I'm going to quote one of my favorite authors. Blessed are those that have a fundamental anguish about this life. Because the Lord says, hey, I'm the man of sorrows. Who better to comfort you than me? I know what this all feels like, to feel a fundamental anguish about this world, about this life. Blessed are those that mourn, for they shall be comforted. I'm the man of sorrows. I can comfort you better than anybody else. Blessed are the meek. You know, it's a good thing when you stop trying to be somebody. It's like a giant load off your back. Trying to be somebody. Trying to live a certain way. Act a certain way. Blessed are the meek, because you're going to reign with me when I come back to earth and show that there is possible on this planet to have a ruler who can rule righteously and perfectly. Blessed are those of you who don't try to be anybody. Don't try to assert yourself. Don't try to be better than anybody else, because you're going to rule with me. I think as I've gotten older, I've decided to care less and less about any of that status stuff. It's amazing. It's like I don't care anymore. If you want to try to dominate me, feel free. I don't care anymore. Because one day, I'm going to reign with him in the millennium. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, because I'm going to fill your God-shaped hole. I had never really heard that phrase, God-shaped hole, until I met a believer in one of my previous jobs who was a recovering alcoholic. She had lived her whole life as an alcoholic and was living under that burden. And she, you know, we talked, and she always used to talk about the God-shaped hole, because before she was saved, she got saved while she was struggling with alcoholism. Before she got saved, she filled her God-shaped hole with everything, and it never filled the hole. And I know that comes from, Blaise Pascal? Is that who's the person who said that? I never heard that for some reason. Maybe he's not a Plymouth Brethren writer. I don't know, whatever. But anyway, the world will have you fill your God-shaped hole with everything. Status, wealth, achievement, all the stuff. You see it all. And you know these people are filling their God-shaped hole with the stuff, and it does not fill them, and it does not satisfy them. It's like junk food. The more you eat, the hungrier you get. Blessed are they which hunger and thirst after righteousness, for I'm going to fill your God-shaped hole. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. You know, we never know how many mercies we've been given. And I'm not talking about the mercy of being saved or the sins being forgiven. I'm going to talk about just day in, day out mercies. You see the obvious ones. You know, the ones where you're like, whoa. But it's the ones that aren't so obvious that you don't realize how many mercies you get. I mean, and I think I am a firm believer that nothing happens or everything happens for a reason, and nothing happens randomly. This morning I'm driving on Providence Road, and there's this pickup truck, and the speed limit is like 35. He had to be going like 60, and he's over the yellow line. He's in my lane, and it's curvy, and there's, you know, these blind hills. And I'm driving old man slow, careful, both hands on the wheel, no texting, no nothing. I'm driving, and he's flying down. And I was able, because I'm the defensive driver, not to let him hit me. That was an obvious mercy. And I'm driving, I was like, okay, there's an example for me. That's an obvious mercy. But how many other unobvious mercies did I get today and will I get on the way home and whatever? And I have mercies showered on me. And what I am supposed to do is recognize that the Lord never gives me what I truly deserve. He's always merciful. And I should be doing that to others. And instead of competing with others on the train platform or whatever, I need to show mercy to others. I need to show mercy for all of their foibles. And when I look at Tracy sitting there, you know, with a little sign, you know, head down, I have to ask myself, what more mercies can I show her? because I have been given so many mercies. And I think the one thing I need to do is this. I need to say, you know, if you want to pray for somebody, pray for this woman, Tracy. I think if we all as an assembly are praying for her, and we're fervently believing that God will do something, something will happen. So we talk about mercies. That's one that we can be doing. But I need to be showing more mercies to everyone, because I don't know, I will never know in this life how many mercies I've been given. It's just, it's amazing. The obvious ones are obvious, but what about the other ones? Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. You know, the one thing that came to mind when I read this, and this will hopefully resonate with those of you out there, and you know who you are with children. I was thinking back when I used to wash Rosalie and Gilbert in that little tubby thing that you put in, you know, and you wash your kid. You don't do them in the sink anymore. That's you don't do that. That's bad. And you don't put them in a bathtub because that's crazy. So you have that little plastic tub that's kind of snug, and you fit it. What happens when you wash that baby and you bring your child out? It's like they see you for the first time. And it's like you see them for the first time. And I don't know if it's the act of cleansing or the water or the bringing out or whatever, but you know what? Why are we pure in heart, those of us who are saved? Because we were washed by the Lord. And when you think about it, and you dwell on the fact that your heart's been washed in the blood, it's like you see God over and over for the first time. Like, wow. Just like I can remember Rosalie more than Gilbert kicking her legs and whatever when I picked her up out of that bathtubby thing. And of course, I'm getting yelled at because I'm supposed to get a blanket on her, but whatever. I'm enjoying the fact that she's like this little pink, wet, clean thing, and she's kicking her legs. That kind of view, that's the first thing that came to mind when I looked at verse 8. You know, as a person whose heart's been washed, and believe me, I am truly cognizant of how dark I can go, to say pure of heart, washed. It's like I see God over and over, like for the first time, like as a little baby when I'm getting hauled out of the little bathtub. It's a really an interesting thought, and a thought that I'm going to keep running with, because that's where I need to put my head. That's where I need to focus, not on a man, on God. We're getting there. We only got two more to go. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. You know, it doesn't say peace lovers. It says peacemakers. And there's a difference, because some people today will say they want peace. So they're almost like peace-likers, if you think about it. But there's not too many people who are literally peacemakers, going out to ensure that there is peace and harmony between them and their neighbors, them and their co-workers, their warring co-workers, their warring neighbors, whatever. There are not too many people that do that. You know, the one person that really does come to mind, and I hesitate to do this in an assembly, but I'll do it anyway. You know, Mother Teresa this week was, or was it last week, was canonized. And it's hard to find anybody who would say anything negative about Mother Teresa. But yet, most people don't want to be like Mother Teresa, because her life was one of sacrifice, and her life was one where she didn't have the things that we want. And let's face it, you know, scrapping with people was actually fun for a lot of people, right? But when you saw Mother Teresa, you know, if you wanted a definition of child of God, there's you could do a lot worse than looking at her and say, this is a child of God. And how many of us would be a dictionary definition of child of God? You know, if you look up child of God, do you see your picture there? It may be true, but how many of us are actively becoming peacemakers? We may be peace-likers, but are we peacemakers? And last but not least, and what's interesting about verse 10 is the result is the same as verse 3. So it's almost like we come full circle between verse 3 and verse 10. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Same as verse 3, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Persecuted for righteousness' sake. You know, the Lord can say, if that is you, I know how that feels. And if you're asked to give what Lincoln called the last full measure of devotion, if you're asked to give your life for the Lord can say, I know how that feels too. I will be your everything. All that I have will be yours. I will give you everything. So, again, that is my rather idiosyncratic view of the Beatitudes. And just to review, just to make sure I'm clear and you're clear, might have lost in the middle, so I want to make sure I get you back here. You know, I contrasted the world's platitudes with God's Beatitudes, not because it was cute and rhymy, just because I'm so tired of the world trying to foist on us its wisdom that is so hollow and so empty. And, you know, it's nice to trust people, it's nice to rely on people, but the only person, the only one who's going to make you resilient is God. Don't put your faith in humans, other humans, or whatever. Put your faith in God. The only one who's going to get me going, keep me going, get me through tomorrow is God. And that's where I'm going to leave it.